Well, this presidential race is expected to be the tightest and most expensive in history, with President Obama and Governor Romney raising nearly $900 million between them. Super PACs have taken in another $870 million after that Supreme Court decision. So how did we get here? The nonprofit news organization ProPublica and Explainer Music have teamed up to put the history of campaign finance law to music. It's a mashup of rap and quotes dating back to Richard Nixon.
I've earned every cent.
Money is speech.
The more speech, the better.
Money is speech.
I've earned every cent.
Money is speech.
The more speech, the better.
I don't like all the influence of money in politics.
When people think of Watergate, they think of a break-in, but they don't mention the money that Nixon was taking from wealthy donors to help him get re-elected. Nixon paid him back in favors just like they expected. To battle corruption, Congress passed a new law, capping contributions to a candidate's hall. The source of the donations had to be disclosed too, and the SEC was formed to enforce the new rules.
Got that? Rappers joining with the words of Mitt Romney, Antonin Scalia. Later in the song, you'll hear President Obama, Bill Clinton. And, of course, Richard Nixon is in there because, as we just heard, the FEC was formed to enforce the new rules, the Federal Election Commission, formed as a result of Watergate. The new song, destined to be a hit, is called Money is Speech, A Musical History of Campaign Finance. ProPublica's Justin Elliott helped put it together and joins us with more from the NPR studios in New York. Justin, welcome.
Good to be here.
So take us back, before we hear more of the song. Watergate and Nixon. That was pretty clear what we just heard, but explain more what Congress did as a result of Watergate.
Sure. So, I mean, as noted in the song, Watergate is sort of popularly remembered as the break-in, but there was actually a major campaign finance scandal associated with it. The Nixon reelection campaign was soliciting illegal campaign contributions, some of which were from corporations. There's one famous example where I believe they took a couple million dollars from a milk producers association and in exchange upped the federal subsidies for milk. So after the Watergate scandal, Congress passed a bunch of new campaign finance laws that sort of formed the foundation of the modern period in campaign finance.
Yeah, sources had to be disclosed, contributions were capped. But then, as the song also notes, there became a cycle of scandal and then reform, and then somebody would find a way around that reform, and then there'd be another scandal. And that happened in the 80s and 90s with the proliferation of soft money. Let's first listen to that part of the song. It starts with the words of Bill Clinton.
We should also curb the role of big money in elections by capping the cost of campaigns.
Now, in the 80s and 90s, there was a new gimmick. Soft money that's disclosed but had no limits. It's supposed to cover each party's expenses, but guys like Clinton used it to help their election chances. There was just one problem. Clinton's party was broke, so he asked for more money every time he spoke. And in return for the $100 million cash in, he let donors use a Lincoln bedroom to crash it.
I never thought I would be bopping along to a discussion of campaign finance reform, but there you have it, pretty well laid out, this idea of soft money. But explain, because it starts out with Bill Clinton saying we should curb the role of big money in elections by capping the cost of campaigns. So square that comment with what happens, soft money.
Sure. So this is kind of a great example of a politician calling for campaign finance reform on the one hand, while on the other hand taking advantage of every loophole and sort of pressing the rules as much as they can. The soft money era, which is sort of best remembered for the Clinton donors who spent the night in the Lincoln bedroom, it was basically a loophole created by some FEC rulings and also a loophole that existed in the post-Watergate law that allowed individuals and also corporations and unions to give unlimited donations to the political parties. There were some restrictions on what they could do with this money. They couldn't just run an ad saying vote for Bill Clinton, but they could do things like voter turnout. And it was virtually the same as just giving unlimited donations to the candidates.
So when we talk about people sleeping in the Lincoln bedroom, Bill Clinton was sort of orchestrating this money that was going to his party, the Democratic Party.
Yeah, directly. And there was, I believe there was actually a menu of perks that donors would get.
Sort of a price list.
Exactly. And the Lincoln bedroom was, I believe, near the top. And I mean, the amounts of money that individuals and corporations and unions were giving in the 90s were less than the amounts of money you see now. It was more in sort of the hundreds of thousands of dollars and maybe a few million dollars range. But it was. I mean, there's sort of a famous theory of campaign finance, a law review article written in the 90s called The Hydraulics of Campaign Finance Reform. And the idea is you can try to stop the flow of political money, but if you, for example, pass a law saying contributions to campaigns are restricted to small amounts, then the money's going to flow somewhere else. So basically, the soft money phenomenon was, you know, the money was trying to get into the campaigns, the law stopped that, so instead the money flowed to the parties.
Okay, so obviously there were calls for reform. That brings us to the McCain-Feingold Act. Let's return to your musical. We're in the middle of Act Two. The scandal and reform cycle happens again. Hit it.
Then the scandal and reform cycle happened again, and legislation was proposed by Feingold and McCain. It capped donations to parties, indexed off funds, and banned corporate union issue ads right before election.
So it's pretty clear. Capping donations to parties, so cutting off that flow of money to the parties, ending the soft funds, and banning corporate and union issue ads right before elections.
Right. So the McCain-Feingold law passed in 2002 sort of ended that soft money era of the 90s and attempted to clamp down on spending by corporations and unions. But there were legal challenges to that, and we really only had one or maybe two election cycles under the McCain-Feingold regime before the courts started chipping away at those reforms and sort of striking down some of the regulations.
Well, and as your song sings, with each new reform comes new loopholes. This time around, it was the 527s, these tax-exempt groups, and they were exempt because they weren't explicit about who they were going to support.
Right. This was an attempt to allow unlimited donations into political campaigns. Now that the political parties could not take unlimited donations and campaigns could not take unlimited donations, the unlimited money moved outside the campaigns and outside the parties to these what were then known as 527 groups. Move On, the liberal organization, had a 527 group. The Swift Boat group, the group that attacked John Kerry's service in the Vietnam War, there were a number of them, although interestingly, several years after the election, the FEC actually ruled that they had broken the rules and fined them several $100,000 in some cases. So one of the ways they were breaking the rules was taking multi-million dollar donations from wealthy Americans, again, later found to be a violation of the rules.
Okay. Justin Elliott of ProPublica, who teamed up with Explainer Music to bring us the history of campaign finance reform. Just ahead, we'll make our way to this election cycle, super PACs, and all the rest. That's in 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back to our look at campaign finance reform with Justin Elliott of ProPublica, who teamed up with Explainer Music to put the history to music. We're working our way through. Justin uses the water as a metaphor, money like water, finding a way to flow. Initially, money flowed directly to candidates. When that was dammed up by regulations, it flowed to parties. When that was plugged up, it flowed to outside groups, the 527s. Which brings us now to the super PACs, which are getting unlimited money thanks to the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision. So, Justin, first, let's listen to that part of the song, beginning with a quote from President Obama.
I don't think American elections should be bankrolled by America's most powerful interest.
But the most outside money was yet to be spent. Some argued spending limits broke the First Amendment. Corporations and unions are entitled to free speech. They took it to court, the Supreme Court agreed. Super PACs can raise as much money as they want. They can also use union and corporate funds. The only rule is that they cannot coordinate with a specific party or a specific candidate.
So, super PACs can raise unlimited money, but they're not supposed to coordinate with parties or candidates. Justin Elliott, what's the sense of how well that's worked?
In effect, the coordination rules have been interpreted so narrowly by the Federal Election Commission that most people believe now that if you give a $10 million donation to, say, the pro-Romney super PAC, it's in effect giving the money to Romney. I mean, you have the candidates attending fundraisers for the super PACs that they're not supposed to be, quote, coordinating with.
You mentioned Governor Romney. He would be standing at the podium. He'd make his pitch, and then he'd step aside, and someone from his super PAC would get up. Because he said, I can't make that pitch, they can. And yet, you know, the coordinating,
exactly.
Yeah, they were coordinating who stood at the podium when.
Right, and there's sort of a somewhat humorous level of self-awareness about where the legal line is. I mean, you also have in the Republican primary, Rick Santorum was actually traveling with his main funder, Foster Freese, who was sitting on stage with him while he was giving speeches. Former White House aide Bill Burton is running the pro-Obama super PAC. So, in effect, these coordination rules are not entirely meaningless, but very close to meaningless.
Then there's yet another avenue for this money to flow, for this water to flow, if you will. You call it dark money. These are the 501c4s, the nonprofits. Now, they're allowed to take part in politics as long as it's not their primary goal. So initially there were organizations like AARP. But some of these 501c4s, these nonprofits, have actually been formed by the same people who are running the political super PACs.
That's right. And the big advantage of these groups from the perspective of those people forming them and running them is that they provide anonymity for donors. For example, there'll be a super PAC, say American Crossroads, one of the biggest super PACs on the Republican side. It's affiliated with Karl Rove. They have an affiliated 501c4 nonprofit or dark money nonprofit. The super PAC, we know who's funding it. It's people like Sheldon Adelson. The affiliated nonprofit, which is called Crossroads GPS, they're spending tens and tens of millions of dollars. We have no way of knowing where that money's coming from.
Let's hear how your ditty addressed that.
Reform opponents were quite done, yet they found new uses for 501c4 nonprofits.
Which are a lot like super PACs with more mystery. They haven't had to disclose donors ever in history.
Whether Republican or Democrat, you might believe that spending limits jeopardize the freedom of speech. But with each new cycle of deregulation, more money's being injected into our elections.
One sort of interesting note here, a less heralded part of the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court in 2010 actually endorsed the idea of donor disclosure, and 8 out of 9 justices signed on to that part of the Citizens United decision. But the way that it's turned out, we have a big chunk of money that's being spent in this year's elections in which there is no donor disclosure. So this is not a constitutional issue. This is a issue with failures in the law and also lack of regulation by the IRS.
Well, I'm a little confused there. So you are saying that the Supreme Court justices, actually 8 out of 9 of them, said that there should be disclosure of the donors, but somehow that didn't translate into the law as it's enacted?
Right. The Citizens United decision actually endorsed the idea of donor disclosure. They said that that was a healthy thing for democracy, and the only dissenting justice there was Clarence Thomas. But of course, the Supreme Court can't mandate disclosure. They just said that it was constitutionally acceptable. These dark money nonprofit groups that we're seeing a lot of activity from this election, they're just nonprofits incorporated with the IRS. And there's been some indication that the IRS is looking into this, but it's a very slow-moving agency, and it's fairly opaque and hard to tell what exactly they're doing or looking into.
Are we in that place in the cycle, Justin Elliott, where there will be reform? And does it matter? I mean, what you've shown is that every time there's reform, there's loopholes.
I think if you look at the history, there have been, for example, the McCain-Feingold law, it did restrict the flow of money to some extent, and it, you know, was chipped away at by various court rulings. So if your goal is to get money out of the system, I think that it is possible to at least be somewhat successful with that. There is a proposed bill in Congress, which is known as the Disclose Act, that is an attempt to require donor disclosure for exactly these types of groups.
Well, and you say President Obama supports the Disclose Act. And again, this would require disclosure of donors to these dark money 501c4s, let's say it in many cases, phony nonprofits. They're actually political arms. Do we know where Mitt Romney stands on it?
He actually has said that he favors donor disclosure. He has also said that he favors getting rid of the limits on donations directly to campaigns. So one of the few intact campaign finance rules is that an individual can only give $2,500 per election to a candidate. Mitt Romney's argument is, if we get rid of those caps and just let individuals and maybe corporations give as much money as they want directly to campaigns, you bring the money that's now in these outside groups back into the system. And the argument is there'll be more accountability. You know, people on the pro-regulation side of this, unless there's a change in the Supreme Court, some of them are starting to focus on public financing schemes. And these are ideas to empower small donors. So if you give, for example, under $200, public funds will come in and match that at 5 to 6 to 1 or something like that. So some people in the sort of campaign finance reform community are now resigned to the fact that we're not really going to have limits on spending or contributions. So maybe the best thing to do is to level the playing field and give candidates incentives to raise from small donors, not just, you know, fly to Las Vegas and get $10 million checks from Sheldon Adelson every cycle.
Justin Elliott of ProPublica, fascinating, telling the history of campaign finance law through music with help of the company Explainer Music. You can listen at hereandnow.org. Justin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
But we're thinking we probably heard enough of it now. So what do you think? Do you think there's any chance of campaign finance reform? Will money like water find a way? Do you have a suggestion? Let us hear from you. hereandnow.org or facebook.com/hereandnowradio. Latest news is next, here and now. Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu, and the Institute of Contemporary Art Boston with Os Gemeos, colorful dynamic paintings by Brazil's most renowned street artists, on view now, icaboston.org.